Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Yes, to be different, my name is Ismail Biryawa. Just wonderful to have all of you tuning in, whether it's via the audio streaming midway 1548 Satellite Islam, and those of you on the DSTV. And just wonderful, wonderful weather that we've had in the last couple of days. Yesterday we had a lovely downpour in the evening. I'm not sure if it's been widespread, but definitely in our particular area, and that's in Gauteng, Indonesia. And looking out of the windows of Radio Islam this morning, brilliant skies, blue sunshine, perfect time to be out in the garden. And there's a number of watch points. If you are going to the garden, remember that you take all the necessary precautions, that you cover your neck, you have a bottle nearby, and that whilst you are working, see that you do not become dehydrated. Those are some of the watch points. But this morning we've got a wonderful guest, and she always has so much information that she shares and brings more knowledge to us as gardeners and to everyone who's listening in, and that is, we're going to be talking to Andrea. Now, Andrea, as we know, I always say that she comes from one of the most beautiful parts of the country, that's the Southern Cape, and she's living in one of the most beautiful, scenic spots, I would perhaps say, rated in the world. I don't know if it's an over-exaggeration, but that's what my estimation is, and just beautiful, beautiful. And we're going to be talking to her lots of things. One of the things that we're looking at is health indicators in the garden. Like we look at and we have our annual checkups, and we say, look, fine, these are the indicators, and these are things that we've got to look out to find out if we are well. We're going to look at some of the health indicators for the garden. We've got lots of other things that we can discuss. And the number to dial us this morning is 854-1548. And the first thing we're going to be talking about is water before we continue with any other subject. Hi, good morning, Andrea.
Good morning, good morning.
Thank you very much. And like I said, we're talking about health indicators in the garden. It's just always wonderful to have you on the program. Now, looking at some of the reports coming in, Andrea, they said that the vol dam has moved up and it's on to about 34%, but we're still not out of the woods. And they say the entire system is in a rainfall deficit situation, meaning that the system has to receive above average rainfall to catch up. And they attribute this all to the El Nino phenomena. Now, have you had this sufficient rain on your side of the world? Because, you people have normally a winter rainfall area. Has it been sufficient, or do you think you're also water-stressed?
Definitely not enough rain. I can immediately tell as well by looking at the way the plants around here are growing. Established trees that are dropping a lot of leaves. Why are they dropping leaves? Now, when a plant suffers drought stress, and you must remember these trees are big, they're mature, they're rooted into the water table. So they're accustomed to a certain amount of water. And when that goes, the tree has to decide what part of its growth it will no longer support. It cannot support all its growth. And then you get a terrible amount of leaves coming off the older leaves because the tree wants to try and maintain its growing point. But then if it gets even worse, then growing points will also begin to die off, and you'll find whole branches dying back. Now, we haven't got that far yet, but it's not looking very good, no.
And then we find that it's, the article I was reading says that water supplies still remain critical in many parts of the country due to the prolonged drought. And we still have water restrictions in our part of the world, and the municipalities have been told that they're going to expect a decreased supply, from the national government. And we've seen that happen to our taps. Sometimes it just runs dry, and we find that the water coming from the reservoir is not sufficient, and you find that water eventually comes into your own homes, and your tap and drips and so forth. So that does cause a lot of problems. And whilst we've had, and people are saying, but we've had abundance of rain, it takes about 7 to 15 days for the rains, for the time wherever it has fallen to reach the catchment areas. So if you have wonderful rains, it doesn't mean that it has reached the catchment areas or it's gone to our dams, whether it's the Sterfontein Dam, whether it's the Vaal Dam. So those are some of the critical issues that we've got to take into account when we talk about. So we may have had good rainfalls in our area. In fact, we have had hailstorms as well. And we've had a storm, they say, one that happens once in 100 years, that flash flood. So a lot of things are happening around there. But if you look at weather patterns, Andrea, changing all around the world.
Definitely, that is definitely the case. I mean, I think we've now come to realize that, well, we are definitely on a warming. Some people say that it's a natural phase that has been hastened by emissions, but we're definitely on a warming cycle in terms of climate. We are in climate change. What we also need to remember is that we have a growing population, and a demand for water, and there is only so much fresh water on the planet. And I recently read a frightening thing on the UN website, and I think that they were saying, whether it was 2030, I think it was by 2030, it could even have been earlier than that, the global demand for fresh water is far going to exceed supplies worldwide. So we also have to keep that in mind. Water is becoming a precious resource. If we want to be sustainable in the way we live and continue to survive as a species, we're going to have to adapt.
And we've had the Marrakesh conference going on, you know, in Morocco with regards to warming and the climate change and so forth. And some of the resolutions they're coming out and some of the innovations are brilliant. But I'm not too sure, you know, when they talk about harvesting seawater and bringing that into the system and make it, you know, so that people could drink from it. So there's a lot of innovative ideas. But like you said, you know, growing populations and, you know, demand exceeds supply. So those are challenges. And as South Africans, I think what we've learned in the last two seasons has to be something that we've got to continue for life. You know, the way we've learned to save water, the way we've learned to use experience. And this, unfortunately, Andrea, has not happened to everyone. Some of us may have learned, but everyone hasn't learned. So people are still in the old habits of still, you know, housing down payments, still washing cars with houses. And irrigation's going on while there's a storm going out. So I think those are some of the things, the challenges we still have.
Yes, yeah, that's definitely so. I think we are very convenience orientated. When something is convenient, we tend not to value it as much as we should. And water is so freely available. I mean, if you just look back in history, a couple of hundred years, I mean, people's jaws would have dropped to see the kind of convenience that we have, drinking water on tap, washing ourselves and our clothes and whatnot in potable water, drinking water. I mean, they would be amazed. We are actually living like kings. And I don't think we're really aware of it, just because it's so easy to turn on the tap and out comes the water.
I think that's so true. And when you take, and maybe some of the experience, just you try and carry a bucket of water, you know, for your own, you know, to your bathroom, from perhaps if you don't have the supply to your normal supply of a tap. And then you only realize, you know, how challenging it is for people who have to carry water daily over kilometers. You know, you may carry it for about 100 meters, you know, if you're getting some hot water or something from somewhere else and bring it to your bathroom. And here people have to do it for, you know, kilometers, getting, you know, buckets of water. Then you realize and you value and say, you know, we have been spoiled, like you said, living like kings, and that's the unfortunate situation. And another quote I read says, stringent water conservation and strict adherence to water restrictions are required. And this is what it is. We've got to learn. And South Africa is a water-stressed country. There's no doubt we're water-stressed. We live on the, you know, on the periphery of a desert. So, and it's creeping in. It does, that desert is definitely creeping into our environment. And, you know, and again, looking at, you know, how topsy-turvy it is. Look at the weather patterns in China, in America. Yesterday was reports, you know, suddenly from one extreme to the other, and that's happening all the time. So these are conditions that we've got to learn to live and work with.
Absolutely, and we need to do it in the garden in particular. I think part of what we need to lose is the Western gardening aesthetic. That entire aesthetic developed around large aristocratic homes. If you were wealthy, you had a lawn. It was a status symbol. Because a lawn, you think back in those days, no lawn mowers and so on. This was a luxury item. This was a way of saying, you know, I've made it, I've arrived. And yes, it does look pretty. And so this became a sort of huge fashion of having a large, green, sweeping, perfect lawn, almost as a status symbol, which has now become very much sort of accepted as the standard aesthetic for a garden. There are alternatives. We also need to look at thirsty plants that need a lot of water. We need to take a long, hard look at them and decide how we're going to grow them. I am a big fan of using grey water, in other words, the water that comes out of things like basins and sinks and so on, and just simply piping it to an area of the garden where my first year plants that I really want grow. And also there's nothing wrong with when you put on the shower in the morning, stick a bucket underneath there while the water warms up, take that water and throw it on your rose bushes. But we need to be sensitive about how we use water in our garden. And we need to start exploring a new aesthetic that is more environmentally appropriate for our area. We are not Europe. We do not have the rainfall. And Another thing that might comfort you, if you do really, really like the cosmic aesthetic of the West, I do, I love it. I mean, in its setting, it is appropriate, but not in our climate, I'm sorry to say. So we are fighting nature when we try to create that. And as I said, I'm not a purist. I have no problem having rose bushes. I love having them. But we need to be sensitive about how we water them, because they can be very, very thirsty. And lawns are very, very thirsty. So we need to limit these areas of our garden that drink a lot of water. There are exceptions. And the one exception I would say is the vegetable garden, because there you are really limiting your carbon footprint with what you grow, even though you are now potentially using water on that. Water would have been used to grow food for you anyway. So if you garden wisely and well and get a nice harvest out of your veggie garden, then you have actually reduced your carbon footprint and your impact on the environment quite considerably. And you can look after your soil well so that it holds lots of water. There's lots of tricks we can still talk about.
Yes, so the food security is very high and has been on the agenda for quite a while. Let us now look at, you know, the health indicators. Like I said earlier in the program, you know, we all have our annual checkups and we go up and say, look, fine, these are the indicators, blood sugar, high blood cholesterol, all those type of things. Those are indicators. Now, a garden also has a set of indicators to tell you it's healthy, and that is the environment that the garden thrives in. Let's go to some of those indicators. And the first thing that we should be looking at is, Andrea, is, you know, what is in the garden, what attracts, or whatever you want to call into the garden, and how to ensure that they are still there in the garden. Let's take a couple of them. And the one I know that many people don't want to talk about, or are but you know, squeamier about is, you know, worms. You know, those when you talk about worms, I see mom is looking up at me and say, what are you talking about? Yes, you know, people wonder, and they don't even want to get near a worm. And worms are good indicators of the health and state of the lawn. Is that correct?
Well, in particular, your earthworms, health and state of your soil is very much indicated by earthworms. What they are showing is that you've got organic content, which is essential. Now, I have a problem with that because I basically garden on a sand dune, and my soil just eats up organic matter, you won't believe. I have very few earthworms. This isn't a good sign. It shows my soil isn't well enough structured. I'll probably be digging all kinds of organic matter into the soil for years before I really start to build up a good basis there. But in normal clay soils and soil, you should be finding earthworms. And I remember I used to grill terribly when I was a student in the nursery school. Whenever you move a pot or something, there's an earthworm sitting under it. And the poor thing is exposed to the light. It's not very happy because you just moved the pot. And it starts thrashing around like mad things. But I was sort of torn because I found them disgusting, but I felt terribly sorry for them exposed like that, lying on the nursery plastic instead of in a pot where it can be safe. And you can't burrow in, and that's how it normally moves around, so it's sort of flapping around on the plastic like fish. And I would be torn to the point that I would actually pick up that earthworm in my hand, much as it used to make me hurl, put it in a pot. I got so used to it afterwards, I didn't hurl anymore. They can't hurt you, they're cognitive, they're good, they're wonderful, wonderful sign of health in your garden. So if you're digging, you see earthworms, be happy, you're doing the right thing, and your soil is in a good state. And then another thing that I would say, if you're going to talk ecological health, and that is going to be some damage. So what I'm talking about here is the pest-predator relationship, the mini ecosystem in your garden. Now, pest-predator relationships work in a situation where you cannot have the predator if you have absolutely no pest. Normally what happens is that if you have a healthy garden ecosystem, and if the particular pest that is affecting your plant has natural enemies in the normal way of things, then you will find a situation where the pest amount multiplies. As soon as that happens, the predators go, yippee, oh, there's lots to eat. They multiply. Then as they start to overwhelm the food population, obviously they start getting less too. So you get much less of the pest, and then the predator numbers also start going down. Once the predator numbers start going down, your pest population goes, oh, yippee, I can breed again. So you've got this sort of constant seesaw. And in a very healthy garden, you will have some areas where you actually have pest damage because of this seesaw effect. like I said, it doesn't always work because unfortunately obtaining that kind of balance is extremely difficult if you have been using pesticides in your garden that are non-specific. And a lot of the pesticides we use are broad spectrum. So in other words, they wipe out everything. They wipe out the pests, they wipe out the predators. Then if that pest gets into your garden and your neighbors have been doing much the same thing as you and so on, it just isn't the ecosystem out there to support the pest-predator relationship. And there are incredible amounts of predators, insect predators, that help us in our garden. Ladybirds, which I'm sure everybody knows, they get involved with aphids and chop them up. Then also...
Sorry, Andrea, you have the orange and you have the yellow one. Are they both the same?
The thing to look at is because there's a leaf beetle that looks very, very similar. I wouldn't try and kill it, really. They're seldom a major problem. The thing is to look at the way the spots and the orange or red is arranged. So if it has speckles, then it is a proper ladybird. And if it has a sort of a net pattern of black with blotches of red or orange, then you could be looking at leaf beetle, which actually does eat plants. But like I say, very small little thing. You know, we never bothered with them in the nursery. We were usually quite happy to see them. We never had any major problem.
Okay, so that's the ladybird. What about the bees and dragonflies? Bees and dragonflies.
Well, obviously bees are fantastic. We need bees desperately. If we don't have bees, we won't have fruit. We won't have seeds. Basically, a lot of the foods. In fact, all the staple foods that we have without bees, just about all of them. Some of them are wind pollinated. But without bees, we are seriously going to be looking at a major menu reduction. So even from a purely selfish point of view, bees are very, very important to the environment. And then, of course, who doesn't like honey? Do be careful, though. Don't try and harvest wild honey on your own. That is not considered among the good idea things to do. But yeah, bees are a good thing. Leave them alone. They'll mind their own business. I have so many bees in my garden, sometimes I can hear them buzzing. And I mean, I can't remember when last, the last time I was stung was when I lived in a house where there was actually a beehive in the wall that I walked past every day. And it was sort of right under the windowsill. So as I walked past, I just sort of walked into a crowd of bees and I got stung. Eventually, after months and months. They're not malicious. They're just trying to be used. Be careful. and we need them. Without them, none of our wild plants would be able to, many of our wild plants wouldn't be able to propagate themselves. I must be careful not to make broad generalizations, but a large amount of plants are pollinated by bees, and they're an essential part of all the natural cycles. So if you've got them in your garden, welcome them. And if you do get bees coming in your garden, don't try and kill them. It's an extremely dangerous thing to do. Rather, get in a bee removal guy. A lot of the guys that are into honey do bee removal, and they will come and they will safely capture the queen. They'll capture the swarm because the swarm will follow the queen into a hive, put it on the back of their bucket, and off they go with your bees. And you at least have the knowledge that, well, those bees went off to a good home. So, yeah, if you've got bees, bee problems, do not try and do anything about it yourself. I know having a beehive in the garden is scary. Like I said, I lived with one for months before I even got stung once. But then I had quite a bad reaction to this thing, so they had to go. So I got the bee man in, and he very carefully dismantled part of my house to get at the beehive. And off they came, and off they went, and made honey somewhere else quite happily, where they didn't bother me.
So dragonflies and frogs. We've got a couple of minutes before we go for the news. Tell us something about dragonflies and frogs. Good or bad indication of gardens.
Frogs in the garden. Frogs are just wonderful. And you know, the croaking chorus, you get used to it. It's actually quite soothing. You wouldn't possibly be able to get away from it where I live. There's frogs all the time. And there's little tiny tree frogs. And then of course the bigger ones, and there's toads and all different kinds of amphibians and froggy type of things floating around. Tiny little cute ones that go hoppity hop, and huge enormous ones that are quite like sort of new. But I mean, really, they can't hurt you. It's quite amazing in this part of the world. I don't know if it's like that up where you are. A lot of people are very, very frightened of frogs. And there's really no reason to be. So get in your house, chase them out of the broom or something. very good thing to have in the garden. Obviously, they're part of the whole food chain. They eat insects. Very, very healthy sign. Shows you haven't been overdoing the pesticides, because frogs are extremely sensitive, being right at the bottom of the food chain where they are. So if you've been overdoing the pesticides, you're going to start seeing deformed frogs or no frogs. At the moment, if you've got happy, healthy frogs, you've probably got a very happy, healthy garden environment there. We should get them. Dragonflies, absolute pleasure. Normally more in the where there's some sort of witch around. But also very lovely creatures to see. And it's really their larvae that are the most predatory, and they are normally in water bodies like player, things like that. And they chomp up things like mosquito larvae very ferociously.
What about lizards?
Oh, lizards, of course. Lizards also, again, because they're quite sensitive to environmental toxins and things like that, you won't have so many lizards around your garden if you've been overdoing the chemicals. So you see lizards, you can go, yes, yippee, and also obviously no damage, catching other insects, some of which will be pests, wasps as well, but particularly ones we don't even see, they're millimeters long, tiny, tiny little wasps. And now what they do is they actually parasitize other insects. So they will go and sit on that insect and lay eggs inside it, and this is quite gruesome. The insect that goes on for a couple of days will happy and then starts getting munched.
And well, we have to stop it here, and we'll continue with it after the news. You take care. Thanks, Madam. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Yes, it's my view of a dear to be different. Just wonderful to have all of you tuning in, whether it's via the audio stream, Midway 1548 Satellite Islam, and also on the DSTV platform. And we've had some queries and questions coming through. It's just wonderful to have all of you tuning in. And remember, you could join our conversation number, dial 854-1548. Some of you are still curled up in bed, others having breakfast. Remember, you could still be part of our conversation. And lots and lots of interest this morning. I've got a couple of questions coming through, and we'll ask Andrea to help us with that. Hi, good morning, Andrea.
Hey.
Okay, we seem to have said a lot of interest. Let's get the first caller coming in, then we'll take a couple of the other questions that have come through. Hi, good morning. Hello, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam, Jibin, go ahead.
I want to find out about orchids. Is it fine to put ice? Is the ice good for it?
Okay, are you going to listen off air?
No, I have quite a few questions, and then another one is petunias are growing outside, but they're growing very slow, so what fertilizer is best for them?
Okay, now
and then there's a fig tree also. What's good for it?
Fig tree, okay.
And when is the best, sorry, the last question, when is the best time to plant guava trees?
Guavas, okay. The orchids, the petunias growing slow, the fig tree to feed them, and when's the best time to grow? When time best plant? Okay. Let's see if we can answer all of those questions. Jazakumullah khair. Right. Assalamu alaikum. Do you have another one now immediately? Okay, let's first take these. I've got Andrea, a couple of questions coming through. And in the previous...
Yeah, quite a few there. Ice for orchids.
Right.
Okay, now, this one, I would actually prefer to consult my husband because he was the orchid grower. But it's for flowering. And that is for Vidiums. And that you do in winter.
Okay. But...
In autumn. Okay. Okay, right. Sorry for that. Yeah, I was just checking with him. I thought I knew the answer, but I don't like to speak out of turn, out of my speciality over there. Yes. So your Cymbidium orchids are triggered to flower by colder weather. Now, I would not put ice with them now because we're really going into the hottest part of the summer. I just confirmed over there with the expert. So lucky, I've got an orchid expert here on staff. But you can do that in autumn. If you want your Cymbidiums to flower a little bit earlier, so you're basically triggering them with a little bit of cold melting water going in there. So yes, but specifically Cymbidiums and specifically autumn or winter to help them induce flowers. Then the other one was what is good for fig trees, right?
Right.
Well, fig trees are pretty tough plants, but they do love manure around the roots. They love it. Well-rotted manure dug in. Definitely give them an excellent boost. If you, I'm not sure how old your fig tree is. That's the other thing that I'm not 100% sure of. If it's a younger fruit tree, you could look at putting fertilizer around the outer rim to stimulate new growth. But on the whole, fig trees should be fairly easy to grow. I'm not quite sure which area the lady's in. It also does depend on your rain. Winter rainfall areas, there are certain varieties of figs that don't do very well at all. So hopefully the variety that she also has is also a good one for her area. And then guava trees, final one, am I right?
Yeah. Now, just let's go back to the fig tree. So that fertilizer, could you use a general fertilizer? Would that be good enough?
It should be absolutely fine.
Okay.
They're incredibly good plants at getting nutrition out of the soil. So if you've already got a fairly nutrient-rich soil. They should actually be perfectly happy. But if you see an ant circling about it, these tend to be on the pale side, then you definitely should think of maybe digging in some nice manure to help build up the soil quality. And then fertilizer, general fertilizer, will give it a temporary boost. Okay. But do be aware that it is a temporary boost. So you don't want to become a fertilizer addict. And that's why I'm saying manure definitely is a good idea, or else a nice rich compost, a mulch of compost, to slowly work in if your soil is already quite organic-y. But all in all, pretty tough plants on the whole.
There was a petunia that seems to be growing slowly. It's not sort of giving up. I think, from what I understood, it's a slow-growing flower. I don't know what you meant by slow, but I suppose not blooming, not flowering. So do you give it a fertilizer, and what fertilizer would you put into a petunia?
Okay, I'm a little bit puzzled about a petunia, because I'll tell you why. There are so many reasons that could be the reason for slow growth, poor performance. One reason could be, and not to... criticize anybody, but there are so many mistakes that can be made with seedlings when they are very, very young. And any seedling that does not get everything that it needs when it's tiny is never going to perform 100% as an adult. The same that we have seen with human beings, for that matter. We know for a fact that a couple of hundred years ago, when people had a less varied diet, they tended to be shorter. You need only look at the doorways on old buildings to see how many guys are nowadays bumping their heads on those, as the species we have grown taller because of better nutrition in our childhood years specifically. Yes, the same is applicable to plants. So it could have been something that happened early on in the plant's life cycle. Another one that could have happened is a small growth regulator accident. This is, again, a growing area that can occur in commercial grain. It's not very common, but I have personally seen it happen, where a growth regulator was dosed at a slightly too high lead rate and actually stunted the growth of the plant. So that's another possible. Then, of course, there are the cultural aspects. So, for example, is the plant getting enough food? Now, I think her best bet to discover whether nutrition will really sort it out is to give these plants a nice big jump start now. And the best way to do that is with a liquid feed. So there are so many out there. I don't want to start banding trade names around, but there are a lot of excellent liquid fertilizers. Mix it up in a watering can. Water the soil lightly first with ordinary water, and then just to get the moisture sort of going in nicely, and then over that with these plants can also absorb nutrition through their leaves. So just water it on the watering can, get the leaves all wet, get the soil all wet. It'll absorb nutrients through its leaves. It'll absorb nutrients through its roots. Follow the instructions. Some of these things will tell you seed once a week. Some of them will tell you seed once a month. There are so many different liquid feeds out there. So I would recommend a liquid feed to give them a real big jump start if it's a nutritional problem. But then if it is a nutritional problem, they respond well to the liquid feeding, then you must be aware that your soil is kind of poor and you need to look a bit better at your soil preparation in the future. And now the last final one that I'd like to mention as well is potting soil, and as compared to ordinary soil. So I had an interesting one where I bought a couple of success petunias, beautiful ones, planted them out. And the ones that I put in soil, beautiful, beautiful, just grew, lovely, happiest things in the world. The ones I put in the pots, they're doing all right, they're nice, but they're looking good, but they by no means have performed the same as the ones in soil. And I've said it many times, growing plants in containers, yes, they can look very good in containers, but any plant, once it is in proper natural soil, that is in a good way, should grow better than it does in a container.
The question about guavas, can you plant them? I know they're in the alien list.
They are in the invasive list, unfortunately. I would check, if you have a young guava tree and you're thinking about planting it out, before you do so, please check its status in your specific province. You can call up nature conservation somebody and ask, or just generally, if you already know your plants, be aware of how much you're seeing them growing around the place, because they are invasive plants and not really recommended for planting. So, yeah. As for when to plant them, they're weeds. You can plant them any time.
Yes, definitely. I think, and we've got to be aware that, you know, this. Just one quick question, you know, with regard to the orchids, we had someone who came in a couple of months ago who said to put two cubes into when you're feeding instead of water, that was the query the person had with regards to watering them with ice cubes.
It's not really watering it so much as that it is giving it a chill treatment, because otherwise why not just use water? It's a chill treatment that they use to boost flowering. So I wouldn't do it at this time of year. You're giving the plant the wrong environmental trigger at the wrong time of year. Don't know if it will be good for it.
Okay, I've got a question still with regard to an orchid. I have an orchid in a small container. The roots are coming out. Do I need to transfer it to a bigger container? And must a bigger container have lots of drainage?
Probably not, unless the plant itself appears to be suffering. I have seen huge orchids grown in tiny containers. Of course, it depends on whether you've got a terrestrial orchid or an epiphytic orchid, but it sounds to me like an epiphytic orchid. Its natural tendency is that its roots are going to start wanting to go out the container into the air if it's an epiphyte. They prefer to flower well when they're quite root-bound as well. So I would not transfer it unless you see that the plant is taking strain, but it's growing like it should. These are looking a bit sad. And in that case, definitely a very well-drained container and an extremely well-drained medium. If it's an epiphytic orchid, you're probably looking at coarsely milled bark with maybe a little bit of fines in between, but not a standard potting soil. That's normally best. And then, of course, there are all the other different media that the orchid grows like. I'm not an expert, but I mean, there's rock wool and all manner of things, but specifically chosen because they're very well-drained. If it's an epiphytic orchid, it was never really designed to have its roots in soil. By nature, it would theoretically have been an epi on top of phyte plant. So in other words, a plant growing on top of another plant, where many of the orchids, especially the tropical orchids, but even our temperate orchids, we find a lot of epiphytic orchids that grow on other plants. But that said, there are also terrestrial orchids, and they're a different cup of tea. They do grow with their roots in the soil. But on the whole, orchids like to be quite root-bound.
Thank you very much. Let's take the next caller in line. Hello, assalamu alaikum. Please go ahead.
Hello, assalamu alaikum.
Jay, go ahead.
I'd like to find out, can we grow our guava trees in our area? Yeah?
Do you know if we can grow, and you are in the Gauteng, am I right? In the Gauteng, Emerentia. Yeah. Can you plant it? Do we know if it can be planted in the Emerentia area? Andrea?
Hello.
Oh, hello.
Can you plant guava trees in Gauteng, around the Emerentia Lake area? Do you know if you could plant?
I'm not sure. I would say that, I mean, Emerentia is fairly central. You'll see it's probably not going to end up in the ecosystem. if you're living in the middle of the city. I still think guava trees questionable. I would check with your local nursery. They'll probably know if it's completely proscribed from the area. But I'm not sure of the invasive status of it. I think the best thing to do would be to go online and check that, because there are certain levels of invasive. One of them is that existing plants can be left, but people are not encouraged to plant new ones. And then, of course, there are the ones that actually get rid of the garden. Now, I have a ceiling guava fall under the... If it's already in your garden, it's okay. Area of protection, but I stand correct. I'm not 100% sure.
Okay, so the best is to check out your garden center, or perhaps the invasive plant. You know, there's a special organization that will be able to help you with that. Thank you very much for Andrea. Thanks, William.
If you just Google it, you will definitely find a lot of information on invasive plants in South Africa, and then they will have a specific designation, and then there's a definition for each designation of invasive.
Yes, whether it's a level 1, 2, or 3, I know that has been. But guava, I have been informed that it is on the alien list, but I'm not too sure which particular level it is at. Let's go on to the next question with regards to, someone says, I've had an infestation of ants. Which is the best way to control ants?
Ants are very, very difficult. The reason why ants are so difficult, it doesn't help you go bumping off the workers. You need to find the entrance to the nest, and you then need to get something into the entrance to the nest and hopefully far enough down to kill the queen. So normally baits are the best solution, because in this case the workers think, oh, here's something yummy, and they take it down the ant hole and then they take it right in to where the queen is, and the whole nest dies out. I know it sounds brutal, but it's the only way to get rid of ants. There are also, by the way, invasive species of ants around the place. You can get basically sugary baits. I would also again talk to your local garden center, they'll be able to provide you with a great formulation to get economical way to get rid of it. But where the ant trails are, put down bait there, so they take it down into the hole, and it's in the story. Other methods of controlling ants, dicey. You know, they you can bump off the ones you see, but then the nest just takes more.
Okay, someone that sent a tip saying that to put down some cucumber peels, and because the ants will not, or worse, perhaps the taste or the smell, they would then move away. But then you're just moving away the ants, is that correct?
You're just moving them around, they're still there. And ants can be a bit of a problem. I had a nest of ants, little innocuous-looking ants that bored a neat little hole in my window frame that I'm not very happy about. But yes, I normally try and live with ants, but they get to a point where there's just too many of them around, and it's like, no ways, it's you or me. And in that case, I'd go with a bait formulation.
Someone has sent in a message saying that she had an infestation of lizards and she had a couple of kits, and now, lo and behold, most of the lizards are gone. Is it good or bad?
Yes, well, you know, actually, lizards might be even smarter than you know. I found this with mice and cats as well. Once you've got them, the lizards sort of, the prey species, shall I say, they sort of get the idea that this isn't a very good place to be hanging around. And they actually start moving out after she has been killed. Is it a good or bad thing? Well, you're going to have this lizard catching insects, but maybe your cat will look insects, you know.
The next question I've got is with regards to the moringa. I spoke about the moringa plant. Do you know anything about the moringa and a little bit of information with moringa?
Well, you caught me in a corner last time with moringa, so I've been doing a little bit of reading up. I wouldn't call myself an expert yet, but I see that it is being sold as a superfood and very expensive powdered leaves that you can put it at. So I went and found out a little bit more. And the interesting thing about it is particularly the leaves, because they contain all the amino acids, which very few plants do. And particularly for people who are vegetarians, this is a good thing because they're getting the full balance of protein. However, they should not think that this should be their sole source of protein. I see that it is recommended to be consumed relatively sparingly. And then it is also purported to have some medicinal uses. As far as I can see, the only one that there is some form of scientific evidence for, and that not yet very strong, is that it can help to balance the blood cholesterol. In other words, that balance between good and bad cholesterol. Apparently, it can help with that, and there is some evidence, we'll say not conclusive, but, science is very, very rigorous. They've seen some indication that it could possibly be good for cardiovascular disease. Several other medical claims being made, only really anecdotal evidence. In other words, people saying this works for me. And that is not very strong evidence, unfortunately, because of the placebo effect, which may affect as many as 60% of people, where you now give them something and say, this is good for that. And they go, oh, thank you, and they trust you. And their body somehow manages to write itself. They're not quite sure how this exactly works, but the body somehow manages to write itself because the mind has told it, I'm getting something that should cure my problem. Very, very interesting field of study if you want to read up about the placebo effect. So yes, not sure, could be, hasn't been researched. I wouldn't want to make any claims in that direction. Sounds like a good thing. Sounds like it's fairly easy to grow. I'm a little disturbed about the fact that they say the seeds are so easy to germinate, and I'm not sure how long it has been grown in our country. Frost tender, so if you do want to grow it in a frosty area of the country, then I would suggest you grow it in a pot and keep it out of the place where there's sharp frost.
Do you know how tall it grows? It becomes very bushy. It has become invasive. Well, tell us something about that.
Well, this is the thing. It seems to me to be relatively new on the whole nutritional market. I'm fairly confident that it's relatively new on the horticultural market in South Africa, being that I was working within that area for about 20 years. I do stand corrected. There might be specialist nurseries that were growing it. But I think it's a relatively new thing. And whenever there's a new thing, I kind of wonder where it came from and how it got into the country in the first place, and has anyone actually worked out whether it will be invasive. We've had some horticultural mistakes in recent years too. That's pink evening primrose that I believe is a huge problem up now in Gauteng was brought into the country as ornamental. So, these things don't always clear past the Department of Agriculture, but I don't know. I was unable to find out. I didn't look in that amount of depth. So I would have question marks there because it's supposed to be an easy to germinate seed. But I suppose if you were to keep it in a very contained way, such as a pot, there couldn't be much harm in that. And it is a small tree. But it is a very small tree in a pot. It's not a problem.
Well, thank you very much for that. Unfortunately, looking at the time, I think we just run out of time. Thank you for all the information and for sharing with us. And we'll be chatting to you again soon. Thanks, Andrea. You take care. Everything of the best.
Everything of the best to you.
Thanks, Malinta. Bye-bye.
And
that was Andrea talking to us about giving us some information about the state of health in the garden and some information about Moringa and lots of other queries and questions that come through. I remember that join us every Sunday on our program Dare to Be Different between 8:30 and 9:30. That's all from me. Until we meet again, inshallah. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.